This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another special podcast on Joy 94.9. Is David Bowie is more Bowie. Can't get enough Bowie podcast.
This is Sonia for Sci-Fi and Squeam. Here on Joy 94.9, the Bowie is here. It's happening. David Bowie is in Melbourne, and it's going to be massive. And it's everything about the man that you knew, and probably a load of things that you didn't know about him as well. Yes, so here we are. And I have with me in the studio this morning, we've got Dr. Dennis Flannery. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you.
It's lovely.
Nice to be here.
Yes, so you are the senior lecturer in American and English literature at University of Leeds. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what it means to be an expert in American and English literature.
Well, in terms of our program today and the topic that's creating all this interest, which is David Bowie, I suppose I could say very basically that I wouldn't be a lecturer in American and English literature if it weren't for David Bowie. Ooh. As a kid growing up in Dublin in the 70s, which was not such a great time to be growing up in many ways, certainly, firstly, David Bowie provided me with a great sense of America as a place via his albums that he released in the 70s and that I was listening to when I was 11, 12, 13 years old. Albums like Aladdin Sane, which is fundamentally a kind of travelogue of his movements around the US with songs rooted very much in New York. There's a song on that album called Panic in Detroit. There's a song very much attached to New Orleans called Time, which is a really great, very classic Bowie song of that era. The Gene Genie, as a single, was advertised as something like written on the road, recorded in New York, mixed in Nashville, or something like that.
Goodness
so David
me.
Bowie, that kind of itinerant, sort of almost Jack Kerouac on the road sense of America, reached me via David Bowie as a kid. And also, I became very interested in reading, partly, which is pretty helpful if you're going to be a senior lecturer or a lecturer of any kind in American and English literature, via Bowie's own interests in reading. I first heard, for example, of George Orwell a writer via the music media when they announced that David Bowie was going to do Diamond Dogs, which began its life as a stage adaptation of Orwell's 1984. I started to read Jean Genet a bit later in life because of that, again, because of this song, The Gene Genie, which is on some levels a kind of a homage or a tribute to Jean Genet. So that's what it means in relation to our topic today, and what it means more broadly means right now for me doing all kinds of interesting and exciting things, some of which are still connected with David Bowie.
So not really much going on there.
No.
Nothing really great, you know.
It's just...
But I didn't think of the Jean Genet, of course.
Right.
It just the connections and the links, particularly with queer culture and queer literature, is incredible when it starts. William Burroughs, of course.
Yes, sure.
Brian Gysin.
Right.
Cut Up Effect.
Yes.
Andy Warhol.
Massively. Lou Reed. I mean, this great song, if we're thinking of the queer aspects of Bowie, Queen Bitch, which is that great tribute song to Lou Reed. It's kind of the great Lou Reed song. Lou Reed never managed to write.
I always laugh when I hear that song.
It's a great one.
I just think, oh my goodness, it's about, really is like a soap opera, you know, cut up sort of crazy and thinking, will these people talk to each other again after this?
Well, who knows? I think they eventually did.
They did,
but
didn't they?
It's a bit of a Lost Weekend song, isn't it? It's very much about the things that could have happened and the things that did. And the truth is,
we don't know,
yes.
Do we? Yeah, look, Dennis, there's so many things going on there. And I mean, you're here for the symposium for David Bowie as well. Looking at that, that's some Friday the 17th. At 12:40 p.m. to 1:10. So there you know your time now.
Uh-huh.
And it's called The Many Faces of David Bowie, Performance and Creativity. So what are you going to be offering?
Okay, well, that's as far as I'm aware, that's a panel. There'll be some other speakers on that panel. So my particular interest relates to what I was talking about at the end of my previous comments when I was talking about the current interests I have in Bowie and what I'm working on there. For the last few years, I've been very interested in the work of a Dutch theatre company called Tonnel Group Amsterdam, who are Holland's leading theatre company. And I became interested in them very much through their work using David Bowie. They very famously, it's been one of the most successful productions, mounted a production of Tony Kushner's plays Angels in America, both parts of them. And they put on this production with a very particular kind of kink. And the kink, if that's the phrase, is the fact that even though these plays have nothing to do with David Bowie and they don't mention Bowie's music or they don't reference him at all, Ivo van Hove, who's Tonnel Group Amsterdam's artistic director and the director of this show, had always this idea in his mind that if he were ever to do a production of the show, he would only ever do it with David Bowie's music, which is what they do. Every single note and mostly every single recorded sound is taken from Bowie's work. And in terms of the visual staging of it, has a very, very bare, very pared-down staging. And really the most visible and vibrant object on stage is a big big metal box with two record decks on it and four vinyl David Bowie albums. And at different points in the show, the characters, the actors just walk up to these to this box and they play live. They put on, they almost DJ, as it were, different different songs by Bowie at different times. They play, they play Golden Years and Wild as the Wind from station to station.
Oh my God.
And very agonizingly and breathtakingly.
When is this coming out here?
Well, the company
I have
came,
to sip my coffee. I'm too excited.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, the company came to Australia. Tonnel Group Amsterdam came to Australia last year with a show called The Roman Tragedies, and that was in Adelaide.
Yes.
Which is a mashup of different Shakespearean plays about Rome. That's an amazing piece of theatre. So maybe they'll come with it. They brought it to New York, to Bowie's home city last year, and it was I saw it there, and it was a truly haunting and tear-inducing and powerful and raw experience.
Wow.
It was really
and
great.
And what, I mean, he obviously is very pleased and, you know, to be involved, I presume, because they're using his actual original music.
Yeah.
Do we know much about the relationship he's got with the group?
And up until very recently, the relationship consisted in the fact that they, perhaps like many other theatre companies or many other you know, filmmakers or ad makers, I mean, the list goes on of people who have used David Bowie's music. You know, that film The Kids Are All Right with Julianne Moore, that features two songs by David Bowie, as far as I remember.
Yeah.
So they were using his music in the way they would use music by other artists, say people like Neil Young or Randy Newman in some of their other productions. But more recently, what was announced in April of this year is that Ivo van Hove, who is, as I said, their artistic director, is now working on a new project with David Bowie, and that project is called Lazarus. So I can talk a little bit about that if you like.
Yeah.
So Lazarus is a stage play that is based on the film The Man Who Fell to Earth, in which Bowie starred in the mid-1970s. It is a play that will have a script written by Enda Walsh, who's an Irish playwright and who also wrote the dialogue for that film Hunger, directed by Steve McQueen, the film about Bobby Sands and the Hunger Strikers.
Yes.
And
amazing film. That's incredible.
And very much a film about agony and isolation and torture. And these are themes that are very much around in the man who fell to earth. They're in utterly grim ways. They're both narratives about danger, men who are perceived to be dangerous, who become or who are thin in many ways, and I think that's a fascinating connection. But what is happening is that this was announced, as I say, back in April. Ivo van Hove is working on this production with David Bowie's collaboration. Bowie has some involvement with the script. All of the music is going to be by Bowie. Much of it will be, from what I can gather, music that Bowie has already recorded, some of which will be altered or rearranged. I remember reading Bowie saying something in an interview. I remember this vaguely about him saying that some of the older songs would be given what he called a new skin,
which is
a kind of an interesting and chilling way of thinking about rearranging a song. And also, as far as I'm aware, David Bowie has written 3 to 4 entirely new songs for this show as well, and they'll be woven into the fabric of this play too. And this will open in New York in December, as far as I'm aware.
Wow,
yeah,
that early.
That soon, yes.
That soon.
My understanding is that this has been in the planning for some time.
Okay.
But that's just my understanding.
Woo. That is incredible. Lazarus.
That's what I said when I read it. I phoned a friend to tell him about this, and he said, Dennis, are you sure you're not making this up?
Sounds too good to be true.
It was reality tinged with all kinds of fantasy.
Yeah. Incredible. Mm. And it's so wonderful that he's having that connection with people who are clearly very talented and creative and taking it to this another level.
Yes.
He must be tickled pink.
I can imagine, yes. I think he must be
honored and feel flattered, but beyond that probably he just thinks, oh, cool, you know, he can get his hands dirty again and make something, a new skin and all of that.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an amazing phrase, if I'm remembering it correctly, of course. And also, with a star like Bowie, of course, the big pressure is, when is he going to tour? When's he going to do this? And my understanding is that he never will. And I think he's very right not to, because
it's the insurance. I believe it was partly to do with the insurance.
I couldn't.
Very hard to insure a person who is aging. He's getting on, and he had heart problems, I believe, earlier,
which terminated his last tour.
So that was it. Yeah. You know, he's got to take it easy. So
yeah,
he kind of is touring. If you think about it.
Well, yeah. Since I guess March 2013, which is when David Bowie has opened in London.
That's right.
That exhibition has been going around the world. It left Paris, I think, and it's going to go on to Holland after its stint in Melbourne.
Oh, hasn't been in Holland yet.
Not yet, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, so it's coming from Paris to here.
Yeah.
I haven't heard if it's arrived. I guess it has arrived, hasn't it?
We will hope, but they say it's going to open on Thursday, that's for sure.
Yeah, very. Well, Wednesday's the media call, so it better be there.
Yes.
They're probably frantically putting it together. So very exciting. Yeah, hard to beat that sort of news. It makes sense. It's the right timing, too.
It does.
I don't think the timing could be any better for the man who fell to earth. Wasn't a big box office contender, was it, when it came out in the 70s?
No.
But it's always had that trickle cult following and really the alien aspect to it, which
absolutely
suits perfectly.
Yeah. And you mentioned the word alien, and it was a massive, you know, you can see the influence of The Man Who Fell to Earth, well, certainly on Ivo van Hove's work, on his other work, say when he directs Shakespeare and things like that, because he's of that age when he would have seen that film as a teenager.
Mm.
But also, say, you mentioned, you know, going back to the word alien, The third Alien film directed by David Fincher references The Man Who Fell to Earth left, right and centre, particularly in its opening sequences. And I think Nicholas Roeg and the kind of emotional and dramatic and erotic sort of ambience and language of that movie, those things have really filtered down into the culture in all kinds of ways. And they've influenced a lot of really, really smart and really intelligent and really creative directors, Fincher being one in cinema and Van Hove clearly been one in theatre.
Mm, great. New York's pretty lucky to get that.
Yes.
Damn.
Yes.
Book your ticket. Saving now. Oh my God. Scrimp and save. Now let's look at the queer aspects to it. And that's something that you've also looked at. I mean, again, I'm looking here, Fincher's film Seven. I mean, those are the sort of things. But for David Bowie, I mean, a lot of people, I've had a few queer people say to me, we won't talk about Bowie.
Okay.
I'm going, okay, why is that? Because he went back in the closet. I'm thinking, well, I don't think you understand it. But anyway, at some point he did deny his sexuality and things like that. Do you think that's a queer culture, that it's important that we have an out David Bowie?
No, I don't. On one level, because I think one of the things about people talk about sexuality and questioning sexuality. For me, sexuality of any kind is a question. You know, we live in a post Freudian era, so sexuality is a question. So I think sometimes people, when they're talking about narratives of the closet or coming out, they're expecting kind of levels of transparency and levels of clarity that really the material doesn't necessarily allow. And there's that really great queer theorist, Judith Butler, and she has a great quotation that I love about coming out of the closet. And she says, she's not talking about David Bowie here. She's just talking in very general terms.
Mm.
Although I'd like to think of her talking about David Bowie. When she says something, she talks about coming out of the closet, and she says, before you did not know that I was, i.e. that I was queer, that I was lesbian, gay, however you describe it. Before you did not know that I was, and now you do not know what that means. which is to say that when people come out of the closet, there's often a great sense of expectation around clarity, a new life, living in truth, transparency, all these things. And we can see the attractions of that, you know, in terms of our own coming out narratives when we've had them and when we've encountered them. Sure, but then, but always there is this level of mystery, and always there is this level of the question around the relationship between selves and sexuality. Mm, so I think that's part of just being in the world, and one of Bowie's great and probably most generous strengths has been the way in which he's probably enabled a lot of people to sort of come out and recognize themselves and be lifelines of salvation to, you know, to kids in the 70s growing up in Dublin, or to, you know, or multiple kids, you know, all over the world.
Velvet Goldmine is a great example of their film.
That's an excellent example. It's a marvelous bit, isn't there, when there's a fantasy sequence when the young kid, the younger version of Christian Bale,
he's
amazing in that movie. He's watching the Bowie figure, Brian Slade, on telly, performing a song that in the movie is called something like The Whole Shebang, but it's clearly based on John, I'm Only Dancing.
Mm-mm.
And he's watching it in this grim Manchester living room with his parents, and he just leaps up in his fantasy and he runs up to the television and he says, that's me, that is. And that's one of those great sort of moments. But what I think is great about Velvet Goldmine is that's not the beginning of all problems and all uncertainties ending. That's actually the journey into other realms of uncertainty and difficulty and pain and mystery.
And that's so very much a queer standpoint, isn't
it? I think so, yes.
Todd Haynes is out, isn't he?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Isn't that how we talk? They're out, aren't they?
I haven't spoken like this in ages. I'm suffused with nostalgia. It all feels very 90s to me. But that's a good thing. Yeah. That's a good thing.
And, well, you know, 90s is the new...
Sorry?
90s is the new 2000s, isn't it? Like, everybody's going, hey, the 90s. And I'm going, hey, what about it? All right.
That's the interesting thing. I mean, I have to keep reminding myself that they haven't ended. But one of the reasons that I think I do that isn't just that I'm getting older, but that the 90s were for me a really, really interesting decade. And also for Bowie, they were a really interesting decade creatively.
Yeah.
And I've often thought that one of the reasons for that is that in the 90s, I think Bowie sort of renegotiated very subtly and very much in the texture of his own work. He renegotiated his own relationship to queer culture.
Mm.
He started to draw on it a lot more. I think, you know, obviously the emergence of HIV and AIDS and very public responses to HIV and AIDS, initially, by artists like Madonna in the very, very early 90s, kind of gave him a push to sort of talk about those things in his own work and do things like, for example, I remember seeing him perform in Manchester in 1995, and he began the show very, very slowly, and he walked on stage with a very long black overcoat thrown over his shoulders very casually that had a very prominent, very visible red HIV AIDS ribbon in it. I think his work in that era, particularly, there's an album called Outside from that era, which music from which Tonal Group Amsterdam use a lot in their production of Angels in America, that really sort of absorbs some of that kind of conflict and darkness and tension. And I think a lot of the time when, you know, people tend to diss the David Bowie of the 1980s, and they might well have good reasons for doing that. But I think one issue in my sense of his work is that either for whatever reason, that his relationship to queer culture, which never ended and was never fully denied, became a little bit more pained and a little bit more distanced.
Mm.
I think his different personae of the 1980s, particularly the Let's Dance personae, the blonde, you know, tanned, muscly David Bowie of the cover of that album, who was very much engaging on many levels in different kinds of narratives of what Adrienne Rich used to call compulsory heterosexuality, that persona was very much around then, and the late 80s and the 90s allowed that to break up, and something more magisterial and sophisticated and mysterious grew up, and that's very
ambiguity too,
I think,
from the 90s, and it sort of made him disappear a little bit. I doubt that the record companies could understand what was going on.
No, a lot of the time. And I mean, from what I've heard and what I've read, I mean, the negotiations around Outside were very, very difficult.
I bet they were.
And, yeah, and he and I think were. by the end of the 1990s, his relationship to Virgin, who released his last album of the 1990s, which is an album called Hours, was very, very difficult indeed. And he kind of relaunched himself in 2002 with Heathen.
Yes.
Which sort of really, which was with a different company, with Columbia, and which sort of allowed those kinds of relationships to queer culture, in fact, to be pretty evident. There's a song called Cactus on that album, a great cover of the Pixies song that is a tremendously queer song. There's a really beautiful song on that album called Everyone Says Hi that allows the speaker to address someone who's often been read as Bowie's son in a very narrow autobiographical way. I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, he talks about in the song, the speaker talks about all the figures in this home who are missing this young person who's gone away, and he talks about the girl next door missing him, the boy upstairs missing him. So there are those little moments of just irresolution and ambiguity and allowances for different kinds of sexual possibility, which, you know, very exuberantly was the trademark of the Bowie of the 1970s.
Well, it was, wasn't it? Yeah, it was pretty much. I remember interviews I might have seen with Dick Cavett or something like that. And he says, boy or girl, you know, and Bowie's very nonchalant about it, you know?
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yes.
Incredible guts to do that.
Yeah.
Do you think he was aware of what he was? Was he conscious of this, or was he just, I'm just, you know, a young rock star at this point in career, and I'll just say what I want to say, being rebellious or conscious of that?
It's hard to second guess. I mean, I think one of the things I've always admired about David Bowie's work is that there's a lovely tension and a kind of a balance between a very intuitive, irrational, very willful drive and a very very cool kind of analytic intelligence. And you never quite know which one is most forcefully operative at any one time, but certainly his work allows both of those kinds of energies to happen.
True.
So I think that there might have been a level just of blind young rock star sort of courage. There might have been a level of very calculated daring going on and, if you like, image management. But also, I mean, you know, I think historically, you know, we often believe that history is a thing, particularly in lesbian and gay culture, we're often encouraged with things like the It Gets Better Project to believe that history is a process of improvement. And, you know, maybe we might wonder about maybe levels on which living a kind of queer life in the 70s might, for many people, might not have been as difficult as dominant historical narratives might like us to believe. I feel that that's the case, and you know, I think there are levels of sort of latitude and sophistication going on in sort of day to day life in the 70s that perhaps have got a little bit forgotten, you know. And I think it's very interesting. For example, I mean, I live in Yorkshire in England. I live in Leeds, and Yorkshire is an incredibly sort of relaxed and sort of ambiently kind of relaxed place in on some levels in relation to stuff around homosexuality. And there are all kinds of sophisticated, you know, complex historical reasons for that. It's to do with, you know, industrialism, mining culture, things like that, in all kinds of ways. And I mention this because the Spiders from Mars, you know, all three of them were a bunch of lads from Yorkshire. They were all from Hull, which is not exactly, it's this relatively remote city on the east coast of England that doesn't really feed into the culture very much. But they really sort of,
such a great name, Hull,
like
the hull of a ship. The hull. What does that mean?
Yeah,
I've wondered,
as I think they would say. Yeah,
right. Yeah, it's I guess it's got that port. Interesting. But I did read somewhere that they didn't want to. The Spiders of Mars, they didn't want to wear those outfits.
Yes.
They were a bit reluctant,
yes,
to resistant, I think, to doing it, and came round when they, I think it was Bowie said something like, or maybe he didn't say it, but supposedly he said, but you'll be able to get lots of girls. Girls love it.
Yes.
And that's
and
like,
they did.
Oh, okay.
And the fans were throwing themselves at them. And, you know, you imagine.
Who would have guessed?
Yeah. Sorry?
Who would have guessed?
Well, yeah. But
boys in makeup could... Yes. Have that appeal,
but clearly, but isn't that the queerest scenario ever? I mean, that there was Bowie understanding the appeal for young girls of boys, and they would have been boys, they've been guys in their early 20s,
yes,
in makeup, you know, of boys who are deliberately sort of and satin and these sort of Regency breeches that they wore and all this kind of stuff, who became these adulated gods. And I mean, I recently watched the Ziggy Stardust movie, the Ziggy Stardust the motion picture, and there's an amazing sequence in that movie where Mick Ronson plays a very very long guitar solo in Moon Age Daydream, and there's a the camera really zones in on this young girl who's just in complete and utter ecstasy, and she's clearly screaming, Mick, Nick, you know, you kind of it's the silent scream.
Yeah.
And that's there he is in his white satin shirt and his silver eyeshadow, and it was all happening. But that was very much a queer insight, and that was I think that was an insight into the, if you like, the queerness of everyday life that Bowie had.
Fascinating that he did that. And then I was looking at some stuff on YouTube and all the links and threads it gives you, know, and ended up like watching these very heterosexual bands trying to emulate Ziggy Stardust and Spider of Mars, and this would be 73 or something when it's over, when it's sort of over. But and you just think, oh my goodness, everybody was copying, obviously, and it's just not the same.
Yeah, but they were
it
taking.
It does look hammy. It looks really. They look very uncomfortable.
Yes.
Whereas the band Spiders of Mars, they didn't look uncomfortable.
No, they didn't look uncomfortable, and the chemistry.
Absolutely. They all worked beautifully together.
They did. And the, you know, the onstage kind of chemistry between Bowie and Mick Ronson was
the famous,
magical. Yeah.
What, the famous
the guitar show. I don't know what time this is going to air, actually. We'll just call it the guitar sequence.
I don't know what you call it. That. It's like probably one of the most famous rock photos of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, Bowie would be in a few famous rock photos of all time. I think that one is the standout one.
Yeah.
And the one with the dog for Diamond Dogs, the dog leaping. I mean,
it's
just an incredible photograph.
It's a staggering image.
It's so... Yeah. It's so masculine. It's really announcing itself, but it's so queer.
Yes.
Because he's sitting back and he's looking like a charming boy, you know? Like,
and he's looking incredibly remote, but also like he's kind of willing the dog to leap at you at the same time. It's very difficult to read.
But that's
the queerness of it.
Yeah. So again, all the things that queer culture brings to popular culture.
Yeah.
I was talking before to a woman and she mentioned Lady Gaga, even Katy Perry. It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah. And it's
and his influence.
Yeah. And it's built into the culture's DNA now, which is probably why he's been monumentalized in the way that he has been.
I know. Wow, we've been raving. This is good.
Sorry.
But if you had to choose, and I've been making everyone do this.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yes, you have to choose.
What do I have to choose?
Well, you have to choose
your
favorite. You have to choose your, because you're looking at well, we've been talking music.
Yeah.
And cinema. Mm. Music video then. What would be the one that captivates you still and says, "Yes, this is the David Bowie I love or admire"?
Can I have a live one?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
It would be the performance at on the Sirius Moonlight tour, and this is on it's the performance of Scary Monsters that he did as part of the Let's Dance tour. Let's Dance as an image and as a sound was relatively sheeny and straight and conventional, but there were moments when really another kind of darkness and roar erupted in it. And if you watch that documentary, and there's a phenomenal performance of the song Scary Monsters and Super Creeps from that video that's really, really worth looking at. If I had to go for just a video that's attached to a single, I'd say Boys Keep Swinging. The one where he gets into three different versions of drag as at the end.
Mm.
And I can remember seeing that video on the BBC TV show Top of the Pops in the 1970s and immediately phoning up my best friend, Des, and saying, where are you watching that? Did you see that? I mean, it was
And this
staggering.
Is in Dublin, too.
And this was in Dublin,
Wow. Yeah. It must have been intense.
It was intense. And it was just great. It was just great
But
fun
also a great relief, you know, see something like this going on. Like, heck, what are they doing in England there, you know?
Yeah, no wonder I ended up living there.
How long have you lived?
Total of 27 years now on and off?
Wow,
I went to university in England. I went to Oxford in the late 80s, early 90s. I've been teaching at the University of Leeds for over 20 years now.
Whoa.
Woo indeed.
Must love it.
I have a lot of love for it,
Yeah.
I mean, like all loves, it's full of... shifting sands and difficult textures, but I do have a lot of love for it.
And
I think one of Henry James's characters says about the English, she says that they are the most romantic people in the world, and this is true, folks.
What makes them romantic?
This is part of Bowie's background. I think it's a culture that values affect and values emotion and values connection with other human beings probably over everything, really, in many ways, which sounds kind of odd, but I mean, it's a culture where collective life and the space for emotion and collective life means so much across the whole sort of texture.
Very intense.
Yeah, as in soccer, for example, as in you know, football supporters.
The fandom probably comes from
Oh, totally.
England.
Yeah,
it's a crazy fandom, which we will see a lot of that, I would say.
I think that's a very fair assumption, Sonia. Yes, very much so.
And weather affects the English so much.
Yes.
It makes them probably congregate.
Yes, it does.
Pubs.
Yes.
Congregate.
Outside pubs. The football
bands
shows.
And pubs and so on.
And festivals. I mean, there are, there used to be Glastonbury, but the country, every summer, the country is just an epidemic of festivals now. You know, it's unbelievable. And Glastonbury is one of the great occasions of the year. It's like Christmas, you know, the airtime devoted to it, the energy devoted to it, the assumption. I was on a train coming back from London a few weeks ago, and I overheard several people talking about, on mobiles, talking about various employees and various businesses saying, oh yeah, well, Danny can't come in. This was on a Tuesday or Wednesday. Well, Danny can't come in because he's just got back from Glastonbury. Or Eleanor's called in sick. She was at Glastonbury. And Patrick was supposed to be here, but I think he's still at Glastonbury. And this is sort of
They're
understood.
All still at Glastonbury. Why don't they just close? They should have a public holiday that week.
They probably should.
They'd probably save money, to be honest. Yeah, businesses would go, oh, well, we're going to write it off anyway. Yeah. This is the least productive week of the year.
Yeah, and they could do that instead of Christmas. It would be much better.
Much better.
Yeah.
And there's something very oldie-worldy and very sacred about Glastonbury anyway.
Well, it's literally a Midsummer Night's Dream. It's the time of the year when the days are the longest, the heat is at its most intense,
and the fairies come out.
And the fairies come out.
That's true. It's like those long shadows.
And of course,
fairies.
It's a venue that very famously, that you can see this on YouTube. Famously, Bowie played Glastonbury in the year 2000 and brought the house down. I mean, he opened his show with "Wild as the Wind." That song again. This is the song that ends "Station to Station." It's a cover of a Nina Simone song. And basically,
beautifully done, though. It's one of my favourites.
Oh, good.
It's a good, 8 minutes long, isn't it?
That's a mere six, I think. But it
seems longer.
It feels epic. But it feels longer in a great way, I think. Don't you think?
Yeah, it's epic. It just, because I love epic movies, you know.
Oh, right.
And people keep telling me, this movie's epic. It's a new movie. This movie's epic. I go, no. So no. Epic movie.
What for you is an epic movie?
Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
And Heaven's Gate.
Yes.
Yeah. And they all bombed out at the box office, I think.
Like The Man Who Fell to Earth. Yeah.
Those are epics. Yeah. Those are, you know, what's the one, the Terrence Malick one? Oh, that is a Terrence Malick one. It's in Heaven's Gate. I think there's another one.
Is it Days of Heaven?
Days of Heaven, that's the one.
Yeah.
Giant.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
They're all pretty queer, really, I think.
They are. Well, I mean, that's what epic allows. You know,
Elizabeth Taylor in it.
is de facto.
Cleopatra, you know, and the list goes on. Yeah. Those are epics.
Yes.
I like epics. So no, when they tell me the sci-fi film is an epic, I go, no, it's not an epic. Sorry.
Yeah. And I think that's been a really, that epic sensibility has been a real part of Bowie's career. I mean, you know, and it's very interesting, you know, he was recording at the time when bands like Yes were releasing entire albums that consisted of three songs and one song would occupy a whole side, for example. I don't think he ever did that. I mean, the closest was Station to Station, which has that Wild as the Wind at the end and the title track, which is 10 minutes long, which is really kind of three songs slammed together into one. But even though he never went in for that kind of physical, if you like, rock epic kind of thing. He's the sense of grandeur about Bowie. I think this is mentioned in one of the articles in the exhibition catalog. The sense of grandeur and the sense of sort of almost kind of Shakespearean emotional sweep and big storytelling is very much there. He doesn't necessarily trade in epic forms. I mean, he's a master of the 3 minute pop song.
Yeah. That is true.
But he makes them feel longer, you know. I mean, let's
When they're put on those albums, they do stretch them out. Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, incredible. And do we know much about his family background? Would it be Welsh or?
I think there is a Welsh element. My memory is actually that his dad came from Yorkshire. I could be wrong, but my memory is that his dad.
His dad wanted to be an artist too, didn't he?
And he had an involvement with circuses, as I recall.
Interesting. Yeah.
And then ended up working for, I think, Barnardo's. Is it the children's charity? After that, and I think Diamond Dogs is in part based on some of the stories that Bowie's father told him about. Mm. Kids in London living rough, not on the streets but on rooftops. That, you know, would have been going on in the mid 20th century and in the and indeed in the 19th century. So I think his sense of if you like, a very exposed, vulnerable, you know, economically and physically vulnerable physicality, or the vulnerabilities of children in those kinds of difficult situations was probably very, 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 very acute. And
you certainly know, gives him that insight, which I think he would have used later on to understanding.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think there's a line from that to him at the end of the Ziggy Stardust singing, "You're not alone."
And yeah, getting everyone to hold his hand. Rock and roll suicide.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Incredible, absolutely. Incredible. And there's a little bit of Pied Piper there too, a little bit of Pied Piper.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
As well.
That's a great analogy. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. And that, you know,
which makes him quite scary too. Yes.
Well, people
it
were
it does horrifying. Make you think, what is he really doing up to? Yeah. I do wonder that.
Well, I think that was part of the parental response to Bowie when I was growing up. I mean, I remember my mother seeing him in a Ziggy Stardust era and sort of, you know, being horrified by him. And I remember being really relieved when he kind of went into his more suited sort of young Americans, David Lyon.
That was when he was the most at threat, probably, of the addiction he had.
Yes, exactly.
So it's interesting.
Yes. But
the straighter he looked, probably the more his life was falling apart. Perhaps.
Absolutely. And and certainly, you know, Station to Station is, on many levels, the vocals in that album are so unbelievably queer in terms of their pitch and in terms of the kind of, you know, there are so many versions of his voice proliferating through that album, and the levels of high singing in that album and songs, say, like TVC 15 and In Stay, is painfully operatic and, you know, shamelessly kind of queer, I would have thought.
He's in pain, it seems.
Yes. And
queer equals pain. No, I'm not saying that, but, you know, maybe. Angst. Love that angst. And of course, Christiane F., you know, singing in German, how amazing.
Yes. And
I love that. And like natural. Yeah. Yeah. Like a natural, like a born speaker to it, you know.
Well, he learned the sounds of the language. I mean, one of the things I love about Bowie is that he's a great listener.
Oh yeah.
And he's very good at listening to other people's music, and when he does sort of live versions or revisitings of his older songs or putting new skins on them, it has always fascinated me how he'll listen to a song and hear another song in it and then kind of produce that. That's a really sort of fascinating thing.
It's a really interesting gift.
Yeah.
The gift that keeps giving, really.
Yes.
The many faces of David Bowie, performance creativity, and you're going to be part of that. This is just amazing.
I feel it's amazing.
I do.
And I'm in Australia for the first time in my life.
Right.
Yeah, I've never been
before.
Wow.
Okay, watch out for the drop beers.
Okay, the drop beers?
Yes.
What are they?
They don't exist. It's just a lie. But there's this sort of virus that went around, an online virus that people were posting pictures of their faces with scratches on them, but they were just makeup. It wasn't real. And it was because of the Australian drop beers and photographs of koalas looking a bit demented, as they can do if you take away their gum leaves.
Okay.
They're actually high all the time.
Oh, right. Look at them. Okay.
They get something out of gum leaves that, you know, clearly evolutionarily is good for them, you know.
Well,
they
nature
made that
in her
connection.
Queer wisdom has provided it. Yeah.
Exactly. So they don't exist. They're not vicious. They probably sleep most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, and eat the rest.
Yeah. Well, I'll watch it. You know, you don't know what you're going to bump into on the streets of Melbourne, so I'll watch out.
But it's a bit of a joke. We always do that to foreign. Well, they do. They do.
Okay. But you wouldn't.
Australian.
Do that, would you?
No, of course I wouldn't. No, absolutely. I'm just a Kiwi, you know.
So we're both foreigners. We're both from
in the dark, you know. That's right.
Yeah.
My one has lots of earthquakes.
Yes.
That's the only drawback.
And
really.
In my one, we sort of behave as if there are lots of earthquakes.
Right.
I guess.
Look, it's great talking to you.
And to you, Sonny. It's a truth.
Dennis Flannery, all the way. First time in Australia, as they say, from the University of Leeds, senior lecturer in American and English literature, but certainly quite the expert on the Bowie.
Well, that's the rumour I'd like you to keep spreading. Okay,
let's keep spreading it. Well, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you,
enjoy.
Sonia. This has been wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the special podcast about David Bowie. It included many of the folks who were at ACMI and the David Bowie Is forums and exhibitions, held only in Melbourne until November 1st, 2015. We hope you enjoyed this. We'll have more podcasts to come.
Thank you for listening to the special David Bowie presentation by Joy 94.9. Interviews helmed by Sonia Hammer from Sci-Fi and Squeam and Queer Geeks of Oz and Geek Girls Speak and Emily Dwyer and Patrick Whalen-Smith from Joy 94.9 and Lauren Stardust herself. Interviews by Lauren Stardust and Sonia Hammer for Joy 94.9. Enjoy this podcast.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.